Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Terrascope podcast. My name is Kyle Hardcastle, and I'm the co-founder and director of intelligence for Terrascope. Before starting this episode, I'd like to give a bit of a health warning. Although we will never talk about terrorist attacks in vivid detail, and the Terrascope team and our guests will always discuss incidents as sensitively as possible, we will be talking about the Manchester Arena terrorist attack in this episode, where sadly many people lost their lives and many more were affected. We all have different backgrounds and life experiences, so if you're affected by any of the content from this episode and would like to speak to someone, you can phone victim support on 0808 1689 111 or find help and support resources at www.victimsupport.org.uk. It's also important to emphasise that our work at Terrascope and these podcasts is never to criticise or lay blame on any security professionals involved in incidents, but to highlight and explore protective security opportunities to help mitigate the threat. In this episode, I have the absolute honour to be joined by two guests, Fegan Murray and Nick Aldworth. Nick is the former UK National Coordinator for Counterterrorism and led the operational protective security responses to the London 2017 terrorist attacks. Following these attacks, Nick recognised the need for the UK to improve the legislative landscape related to protective security. In 2018, Nick met our other guest, Fegan Murray, the mother of Martin Hett, who sadly lost his life during the 2017 bombing at the Manchester Arena. Building on their shared passion to improve protective security within the UK, a strong friendship and working relationship grew. Utilising Nick's knowledge of protective security needs, alongside Fegan's ability to articulate the impacts that terrorism has on victims, survivors and their families, they campaigned for change and the creation of Martin's Law, otherwise known as the Protect Duty. As if this wasn't enough, Nick shares his expertise across the globe and founding Risk to Resolution, providing sought-after threat and risk services to businesses. And Fegan has become a terrorism academic, having completed a master's degree and proactively shares her knowledge at events and conferences across the UK and further afield. In 2020, Fegan was presented with the Counter-Terror Outstanding Contribution Award and was also rightly awarded an OBE in a 2022 New Year's Honours List. So Fegan, Nick, a very warm welcome to Terrascope Podcast, and thank you for being our very first guests.
Thank you.
So for our listeners who haven't heard of Martin's Law or the Protect Duty before, I was wondering if you could provide us with an overview of what it seeks to achieve and why you feel its implementation is so important.
Off to you, Fegan.
So Martin's Law is basically something when Nick and I met and Brendan Cox came on board as well. Nick very kindly drafted a document that we then took to the government, and that contains five key points. Number one would be that we are asking people to undergo the ACT e-learning training, which is the very basic 45-minute training, in the very least, that is free of charge, of course, and given by the government. The second one is that people do a risk assessment both inside and outside of their premises to see if there's any vulnerability. Number three would be to mitigate any risks identified during the risk assessment and deal with them. Number four would be that the venue has a counterterrorism action plan, and staff actually know what it is, where it is, and what's in it, but also that staff know and understand what to do if there was ever a terrorist attack, where they maybe evacuate staff and customers, etc. And the final one is that the local authority is prepared.
And look, I mean, I would only simply add to that, and it's quite funny, almost our roles have been reversed. And normally I'd give a spiel about the technical requirements and Fegan would talk about the real raison d'etre, Kyle, which is nobody should ever have to be in the position that Fegan and others have found themselves in. And, we all passionately believe in this, because I know what your heritage is, obviously, Kyle. We all passionately believe that You know, people aren't harmed through acts of terrorism, and we passionately believe we are able to do something to prevent that from happening in the future. But the problem with security is that it's discretionary, and that means that quite often it's not delivered effectively, and in some cases not delivered at all. And I know that, you know, when Fegan finds herself in those situations, and when other victims and survivors of terrorism find themselves in those situations, it amplifies the trauma. And, you know, really, in this day and age, there should be no reason why we live in a society that doesn't look after each other.
Completely agree. And I've had a number of conversations with people that work within, and as I'm sure you, I know you both have, in the private security sector around the protect duty. But I've also had, you know, spoken to my friends and family about the protect duty and what it's trying to achieve. And quite often the response I get from them is, does this not exist already?
Yeah.
I think there is that assumption of people that are attending events or all these venues that all of this sort of stuff, very similar to almost like health and safety standards, that surely legislation already exists to kind of ensure that people who are, you know, security professionals and are responsible for the safety of others would have some kind of legislation that kind of at least sets a minimum standard of what they should be doing. And I think the general public are quite naive to the fact that this sort of legislation doesn't already exist. So what type of businesses and locations will the protect duty specifically relate to? Is it kind of the big stadiums and big venues and smaller businesses? Is it targeted at any particular type of business or venue?
John Figgin, you've been speaking extensively about this for the last day or so.
Well, obviously it is... what we want is we want small venues to be protected, because the big venues, like Nick always says, already know what to do. They're not all doing it because there's no legislation and they don't need to do it. But if once the legislation is out, if they have to do it, they'll do it. Then they know what to do, and they'll probably also have the equipment or the funds to get the equipment. However, the smaller venues who don't know about the protect duty, who don't know about Martin's Law, who never even give security maybe a second thought because they're oblivious to it, it's those venues that are really at risk. And like we've seen worldwide, we had Borough Market where small venues were targeted. We had the cafe in New Zealand. We had McDonald's in Germany. We had... you know, Christchurch, a small mosque. We have smaller venues that are actually targeted. And you know, I could name a whole list if I put my head to it. But it really is important that those people are protected.
And I would reinforce one of the positive things that come out of this campaign already is that it's forced the government to rethink the crowded places model, and they've moved toward this model of publicly accessible locations, for which there is now a definition, which effectively means any place on payment or otherwise that the public has use of. And linked into that now is work being undertaken to figure out how to connect places, you know, in zones, and how to connect places where there's shared space. So look, already the campaign on its own and the need to think about the protect duty has created some transformation around that sort of thinking. The crowded places model, as was a good model for its day. It's what we understood at the time, but it only captures 0.02% of what are generally regarded to be crowded places in the UK. And the estimate for those is about 650,000. It's important that the application of this is as wide ranging as possible, for exactly the reasons Fegan has just said. Other than Manchester, I can't readily think of a high capacity venue that has been attacked in recent times.
And I think this, you know, public accessible locations, sometimes I've heard areas referred to as like the grey spaces. So those kind of public areas, as you mentioned then, that where you've got pavements, and by virtue of a number of different venues within that vicinity has created what we would call a crowded place, somewhere that could potentially be vulnerable or desirable for a terrorist to target. How do you see the perpetuity working with those spaces where there's not really any one organisation or person that has responsibility for that location, but maybe like a group of businesses within a defined area. How would you like to kind of, or both of you as well, Fegan, how would you kind of like to see the perpetuity work in that sort of environment?
Nick, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So I'm not sure that they will necessarily be able to legislate for space that doesn't have an owner. But therein lies, I think, a really important point. There is almost no space in the country that doesn't have an owner. And you know, one of the things that's becoming really clear around people's thinking on the protect duty is that this is as much about accountability as it is about, you know, action. And when you have a space that it starts to get to be used for a specific activity, an event, you know, even something as simple as a coffee morning, if you want to have it in your local town square, you are by default creating a potential target, and therefore whoever is the organizer, the owner or the operator of that particular event should have the obligation to make sure that security is considered. Now, and I'm sure we'll move on in the conversation in a moment, what we most definitely are not advocating is that, you know, Mrs. Miggins with her 100 people Macmillan coffee fundraising event starts to install hundreds of thousands of pounds of hostile vehicle mitigation around the building. You know, we're not in that space at all. What you are looking at in those sorts of activities is just thinking about a plan and thinking about consequence management.
Yeah, and it's also about proportionality, isn't it? Because I think that's caused a big hoo-ha, the proportionality aspect of things, because people went a little bit, they were concerned about the cost implication. And actually, we're not asking a small pie shop who does a tea party to have, security guards at either entrance or anything like that, or buy expensive scanning material. What we are asking for is basically use your common sense and do provisions. You know, if you are a small cafe and the legislation comes in, it may not be a good idea to put coffee tables on the pavement right near the street, because a vehicle could mount and kill your customers. So it's that kind of stuff. It's common sense. Some of it doesn't cost any money. Just don't put chairs out. You know, if you have a garden, put them in the backyard, whatever. Make your backyard look pretty and put your customers there. It's not necessarily a lot of expenditure that we're asking people to sort of lay out. It is literally applying common sense, and obviously the bigger the venue, the more safety measures there have to be. On the other hand, if it is a cost issue, you know, we had a lot of flack, didn't we, about cost in the early days. And I mean, I did a dissertation about costs because it really bothered me, the criticism. And actually, you know, take the Manchester Arena, that holds 21,000 people. If you had a concert there 5 days a week, even at half capacity, say 10,000 people, and you charge them 50 pence security levy per ticket, that would generate £5,000 per concert and £25,000 per week. And if you multiply that by the number of weeks, even at half capacity, that will raise a phenomenal amount of money for just one venue. And, you know, and then people said to me, well, we don't sell tickets, you know, we just serve food and drink. Okay, add 20 pence per cup of coffee, 50 pence per meal, get creative. You know, if you are an exhibition centre, if you charge somebody £10,000 for a stand, charge them 10,200 and raise that extra money needed for security. Ring fence that, show that in your annual reports as security levy and expenditure, and use it for equipment, for staff training, for staff wages to make sure that they're adequately paid. And that can all be achieved.
Definitely. And I think now organisers of events and venues, if they were open and honest with their customers that a small levy has been added to their entry fee or ticket and that it's been used for security to prevent atrocities like we saw with Manchester Arena. I believe that many people would be very accepting of that and happy to pay that small additional amount. So one of the things in the protect duty that was raised following the consultancy process, and something that I know has been raised and talked about within the private security sector, is this concept of a competent person. Specifically, it states a requirement for a competent person to undertake detailed, subjective risk assessments to identify vulnerabilities and appropriate proportionate mitigation measures. As I said, I know that there's been lots of discussion about who or what a competent person is or should be and what sort of standards should be required. But I was wondering, in your mind's eye, what vision do you have of what a competent person should be?
So I think when we're both not quite on the same page, I don't think, around this, and I'm definitely not on the same page as some people on this, because certainly our, and this is where we are on the same page, our vision for the protect duty was easy access, low cost, no cost, capable of being engaged with by anybody who needed to engage with it. And in my mind's eye, that excludes the need to start bringing in specialist skills, unless you find you've got particularly specialist mitigations that you need to create. And I think my concern around the competent person scheme is I haven't seen the answer to the question, and the question is, competent in what? Mm-hmm. Because the security industry and the delivery of protective security, and counterterrorism, has so many strands. What is it that you're actually asking people to be competent in? Is it, you know, engineering skills to make sure that your bollards are the appropriately rated and installed properly? In which case, possibly you might need somebody who's properly certified to do that by the manufacturer. But that's not a competent person scheme. That's, you know, that's the same as somebody installing a door in my house. They need to know how to do it. And if they don't do a good job on it, then, you know, there's a consequence. Do you need to have specialist knowledge to do threat and risk assessments? So I come very much from the school of counterterrorism is not the dark arts. It's about bad people who want to do bad things using a range of opportunities to do those things. And that's about as difficult as a threat assessment gets. And all that information is currently provided to us. It's available on the new Protect UK website. It's available from the MI5 website, and it's called a threat level. And the threat level is, it says it's likely, it's highly likely, it's not likely, or whatever the threat level might be on any given day. And this is the problem I find with threat assessments in particular, is people refuse to accept it at face level, because there is no intelligence about when stuff's going to happen. You know that. And if there is, that's the day we go to critical, and there's a whole load of state-driven mitigation wrapped around the problem. So I don't think you need to be a competent person scheme to undertake a threat assessment. I think you can get those, you can download those, you can buy those, you can, you know, ask people, and you can use common sense. Risk assessment, possibly, but again, the vulnerability and consequence elements of risk, again, are not difficult. Simple questions. Can somebody drive a vehicle into people at my premises? Yes, no, maybe. Can somebody bring a knife into my premises without me knowing about it? Yes, no, maybe. Can somebody bring a device in a bag in my premises? Yes, no, maybe. And you know, if all the answers to those questions are yes, then you've got a risk. Unless you've got a corresponding set of questions that reduce that risk by managing the consequence. And I don't think that needs any specialist skills. It needs a platform, it needs an app, it needs a tool. And that is what I was hoping would come from Protect UK. I don't think it's quite there yet, but they certainly know my view around that.
Yeah. And I come from this as a layperson. You know, I didn't have anything to do with security before Martin died. But I tend to compare if we do need a competent person scheme in the first place, I compare that to my previous job as a therapist. And in our industry, in the therapy industry, it was fairly regulated. You needed to have your basic training. If you wanted to specialize, you had to have further training. If you wanted to work in certain organizations, you needed to do their in-house training. But on the whole, we had an umbrella organization that you had to be a member of. You had to adhere to their ethical conduct and you had to stick to those guidelines. But in addition, as a member, you had to do a certain, I think it was 30 hours a year, continuous professional development. You also, in order to be employed by more bigger venues, bigger places, organizations, social work, social services or hospitals or educational places, you would need to be accredited. They wouldn't even touch you without accreditation. And that accreditation is academic and you'd have to make sure you write case studies and you'd have to be accredited every 5 years. You'd have to go through it again. And in the meantime, they would take a 15% sample of all therapists and audit them, not just the one-off. If you get picked, if you're the unlucky one, they will audit you for an entire year and make sure they ring course providers, checking whether you attended and finished. They will ring your clinical supervisor to check whether you attend regular. They do everything very, very thoroughly. So there's no place to hide. And that you need to constantly update your skills base as a therapist in order to work safely. And you have to also have clinical supervision once a month, which was one of my other jobs. I had loads of people are supervised to make sure they work safely with customers and clients and don't damage them. And so it's a very regulated industry, which a lot of people maybe don't know. But in security, that seems to be not quite as structured.
And I think, you know, just to clarify my position, is that I definitely don't disagree with people undertaking learning and, you know, continuous professional development. I laud people that do that. I try and do it myself. And, you know, I'm very aware that there's a lot of people out there who call themselves security experts because they've been in the police or they've been in the military. And of course, that doesn't make you a security expert. It makes you a police expert, possibly, or a military expert, possibly. But I think the dilemma that they've got to overcome and certainly, you know, persuade people that it's worthy of investment, because in fairness, you know, certification does usually come with a degree of cost. That everybody's in a level playing field and that what they're asking to be certified as competent is what needs to be certified. So, you know, not everybody that does health and safety assessments in the workplace has done an EBOSH course or has had an IOSH training. You know, health and safety is, again, the application of common sense in most cases. So, I'm intrigued to see what comes out from it. I won't push back on it. I'll clearly always make a comment where a comment is due. But I posed the question to them recently, which is, look, I'm not a security expert. I'm a copper. And I hate anybody who suggests that I am, because I don't know the first thing about security. I don't have any formal qualifications in threat and risk. People like you, Carl, used to do that sort of stuff for me. I used to just run a business effectively that made sure that the services people needed were coming out. So am I a competent person? I have no idea. I mean, plenty of people will argue that I'm not, but it's but that's where I think the challenge lies, in, you know, making sure the definition and the need is properly validated. And worth doing, because it will come with pain and cost. And the last thing I'd say on it is the other reason I'm a little bit opposed to it is when you look at the totality of the task for 650,000 venues that need to be protected, the market does not exist at the moment to deliver into 650,000 venues. It really doesn't. And actually, I think what the risk of creating a competent person scheme and saying only these people can do it is that it will slow down the implementation of vulnerability and risk assessments?
I think where the protect duty is concerned, obviously there's still questions around how it's going to be operationally implemented. But I think it's really important that the security sector really keep sight of what's at the heart of the protect duty and the reason why it's come about. And it's this, you know, the encouragement and assurance of a security mindset that considers a realistic threat and how we can help deter and protect, saves lives, essentially. And if we're all honest, I think as security professionals and event organisers or venue owners, even without the protect duty or any kind of legislative obligation, if we're all honest, we already have a moral responsibility for it. And as we've already kind of discussed, I think there's also public expectation that we're, you know, meeting this need and taking on this responsibility. So quite often at the moment, I've seen in a lot of material and a lot of conversations I've had with other people within the private security sector, I've quite often heard the phrase, are you ready for the protect duty? So considering the fact that really these locations and these venues shouldn't be waiting for the protect duty to come out, this is something that we should already be considering and doing. What would you say are the things that you would like to see right now that the security sector was starting to put in place before even the protect duty comes out to start trying to work towards this ideal situation that we'll get ourselves into to increase that protection?
Well, the word ideal is a bit of a tricky one, isn't it? Because the government haven't actually issued the legislation, so nobody really exactly knows what's going to be in it. So, but I do know a lot of venues up and down the country are actually already trying their best to implement the protect duty. You know, I get messages all the time saying they're doing the best we can already, and but nobody has a guarantee about whether they're doing it right or wrong or sufficient enough. It is encouraging. The other thing that I want to pick up on is public expectation. Well, actually, the public don't expect security because then it's not on their radar. And the reason I'm saying that is, you know, as I said, I used to watch terrorist attacks on TV and, you know, see people cry and hug each other. And I'd think, oh, my God, those poor people. It's terrible what happens in these countries, you know, talking about school shootings, talking about, I don't know, attacks in Nice and in France and, you know, in America, elsewhere. And I used to think, gosh, those poor, poor people. And then I'd change the subject, change the channel, and because it had nothing to do with me, really. And I think a lot of people are like that, that it doesn't really affect them directly. And therefore, they don't get their head around the fact that it could actually happen. And people often say to me, well, terrorist attacks are really, really very rare. Well, I disagree. They can increasingly happen. And because of the lone actor self-initiating in their bedrooms, it's become very unpredictable whether an attack is going to happen or not. So I think as a general public, there has to be, it's no good just the security industry doing all this work. I think there's got to be a drive to educate the general public about it. And again, I wrote in my dissertation about that I feel that as a nation, we need to be more resilient. And I touched upon the work on Lord Toby Harris, who talks about resilient citizens. And you know, that he's saying we need to be ready for terrorism, we need to be ready for floods and fires and drought and all those kinds of things. We as a society need to harden ourselves a bit and know what to do. And I happen to agree, but in society, we are not there yet with security, where people say, actually, why did you not check my bag? Why did you allow that person in with a rucksack? And, oh, by the way, somebody's left that at the station near the stairs. I don't know what's in it. People are not questioning stuff enough because they don't even see it. They're oblivious to it because it's not on their radar.
So look, I'd go one step further and say it's more than a moral obligation, a moral duty. I would suggest to you that there's now a public liability attached to it because we can't unknow what we now know. And part one of the Manchester era inquiry laid bare so many failings in what good security should look like. that if we're not aligning what we all do now and something happened, I think you have a really significant exposure to, public liability claims. And so my first message to any of those people that are hosting events where people come and you're responsible for looking after them is, folks, you've got to do it properly already, because if you don't, it's going to cost you a lot of money. But on the more positive side, what I think the duty will do, Carl, is it will get people to start understanding both that moral and public liability, and they'll understand the what is quite frankly a really simple framework in which those liabilities are mitigated. And so the message to them from me would always be to start with understanding what threat is. You know, I was at an event yesterday, a really sophisticated event, high-end security professionals looking after national infrastructure, about 150 of them, I think, in the audience. And I said, who, put your hands up, please, if you've got a threat assessment. Guess how many hands went up? It shocked me. None. Not one hand went up. And I thought, well, the point that I would always then make is how can you understand what your vulnerabilities are if you don't even know what your threats are? You could be pouring good money after bad, mitigating things you don't need to mitigate because you've not done your homework properly. So my first message to people is, look, just understand the threat. And the threat is really easily understood because it's the first part of Martin's Law, which is, get some of that awareness training under your belt. ACT e-learning is a great product, and there aren't many countries out there knocking this stuff out of that sort of quality and for free. And then once you start to understand the threat, then you can start thinking, okay, so if that did happen here, what would be the consequences of that? What could happen? And if, if you've done that and you then just had a plan, if you just did those two things out of the four core elements of the protect duty, you and I are going to be in a better place. You and I remember that that Christmas in 2017 where we had that mad panic in Oxford Street. And you look at some of the video from CCTV in the stores there, and people were getting hurt because nobody had a plan. Thankfully that wasn't a real event, but still people got hurt because of the panic, the crush, the sheer terror that some people were experiencing. But somebody, in the middle of it saying, right, you go that way, you go that way, you lock the doors, that would have stopped people getting hurt. So I think there are steps that people would need to be thinking about now, and they are as simple as, they are as simple as that.
Definitely. So obviously the protect duty hasn't been formally passed by government yet. It's not in force, and we hope that that happens in the very near future. But what do you see are the biggest challenges at the moment with getting the protect duty over the line and in place?
The thing is, people are trying, but nobody really knows what is enough or what is too much, because, as I said, nobody seems to know exactly what the government has planned. And I have asked several times during conversations with government, with the Home Office Department, with the security ministers that I've met, with Priti Patel, I've asked all of them, can you please at least give us a framework to work on, some guidance, so that we know people are barking up the right tree. Nobody has given us anything as yet. So therein lies the frustration, and therein lies a complication for the industry, because, we've almost got to a point where, we can't move any further. We keep talking about it and talking about it. There's lots of conferences about it. There are webinars about it. But nobody has the end result yet. We just simply don't know. And I am urging the government to make sure it's at least out for definite by the 6th anniversary.
So, Nick, how about you? What do you think some of the biggest challenges are at the moment for the protect duty?
So I think the biggest challenge at the moment is clearly the political and social turmoil in which we find our country. And, you know, I'm pragmatist. And I recognise that, you know, when your country is financially on its knees, you've got to do something about that pretty quickly. But obviously, the first duty of any state is to protect its citizens. And so you now have this real conflict between a government that desperately needs to resolve probably the biggest crisis that you and I are hopefully ever going to experience economically, as well as conclude and conduct business as usual, of which, you know, developing legislation is one of those things. And I think there's perception in government that the protect duty will create burdens on businesses that might already be a bit fragile. And I think what we all have to do is to continue to project the message that that isn't the case, and that low and no cost is really what this is all about. I don't think it's been helped sometimes by the number of people out there who are already selling protect duty products and services and pitching any number of really effective systems, admittedly, but on the back of you must do this because of the protect duty. I think there's a risk that we scare the horses by being quite so blatant about what are perfectly reasonable commercial opportunities being generated. But I think that for most people, the protect duty will just be opportunity cost, i.e. an hour out or 45 minutes out to your act awareness e-training, a manager taking a couple of hours out to read a threat assessment available for free on Protect UK or whatever platform they want to choose, and maybe a few hours to go through some fairly simple questions around, you know, vulnerability and consequence in relation to their premises. And I tried to quantify this the other day, and I thought, you know what, if you've got the right tools around these people, that's probably about 10 hours of work. And an awful lot of people who work in the industries that are going to be affected by Martin's Law are generally on sort of living wage or there and thereabouts. You know, if this costs a business more than 100 quid a year, I'll be quite surprised. Clearly, some will then find vulnerabilities they've really got to do something about. And you know, clearly there's going to be a liability imperative, particularly where, you know, the consequences will be high. But they should be dealing with that already, you know, regardless of the law or not. The law per se, I don't think will change the financial footprint, but I think the government is concerned of what the perceptions might be. So the security industry have been incredibly supportive. I know how grateful Fegan is for, you know, the number of people who are championing her cause. My ask to, you know, any of your listeners is to please keep championing the cause. Please write to your MP. Please write to the security minister. You know, all these people are on LinkedIn nowadays. They're all on Twitter. So you haven't got to go writing, you know, letters on vellum paper and hand delivered by page. Just, you know, get in there and make our voices heard.
So Fegan, Nick mentioned that the Protect Duty is getting a lot of support from the private security industry. I was just wondering, what would be your ask of security professionals now based within the UK?
Yeah, you see, so I'm becoming a little bit more vocal on social media with the security industry. For some reason, I ended up becoming a little bit of a figurehead, which I was never my intention and never even thought that would ever happen to me. But I can't do that just as a figurehead. We need the industry as a whole. It's no good saying the security industry is behind you, Fegan. I need the security industry to start becoming vocal to the government and demand from the government that they're finally producing the legislation, that it's needed, it's badly needed. Everybody's waiting for it.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, again, from conversations I've had with various different companies of all different sizes within the security industry, there is a very, very strong support behind the Protect Duty. I think a lot of people do see it genuinely for the reasons why, you know, we want it in place, and that is to essentially protect people and save lives, rather than making more red tape and more kind of obligations for people to do. People are seeing it genuinely for the real heart, the reason why you and Nick paying for this legislation to be put in place. So for the purposes of our listeners, we're actually recording this podcast on a day after the release of part two of the Manchester Arena inquiry. Fegan, you and your family and friends were obviously personally impacted by the abhorrent events that occurred on the 22nd of May back in 2017. And I'm sure that some of the findings were quite painful to read and listen to. And Nick, like me, as an ex-police officer, have both of us having spent many years working with counter-terrorism, it was also hard to read about the shortfalls in emergency service response at that particular incident. So from your kind of personal perspective, what do you think are some of the key learning points out of the inquiry so far that the security sector and policing really need to be taking away?
Yeah, so as I read the inquiry documentation, I made myself some notes. And what jumped out at me, obviously, there was 25 pages of recommendations, which nobody can go through so quickly, but I feel that some of them that jumped out at me was obviously the biggest issue was absence of communication between the services and also within each service with other people within that service again. So the communication all round needs to be improved. And what came out of that also for me personally is that there seems to have been a disaccord in terms of terminology, that one service would understand this with that word and another service would understand that with the same word. So there's got to be they need to put their heads together, all of them, and say, okay, what does this terminology mean for all of us, so that when it happens we all know what it actually means. Another one was understanding each other's capabilities, resources, expertise within each service, but also limitations. What they can and can't offer, that operational procedures are going to be updated on a regular basis, but not so often that people feel overwhelmed reading it, you know, constantly, because that was an issue, I think, in the inquiry with some of the evidence that was given, that actually there's operational discretion being used and people are not complete and utter sticklers for rules when there's lives at risk and people take their initiative. And action cards, that was mentioned, that, you know, these are all things that actually can fairly easily be resolved. We have the technology available, we have the expertise available to do all these things. And what was interesting was what Judge Saunders said about trauma kits. You know, I had a conversation with SIA recently saying, you're offering first aid, please add a bit more and offer life-saving training. You know, teach people how to do tourniquets, how to use defibrillators, pack wounds. And they were reluctant, and I'm not sure what that reluctance is about, because I've done the training and, you know, I encourage the general public to do that training. It's vital, and Sir John wants it in schools. He wants it, you know, in the national curriculum. He wants the general public to learn those skills, and he wants police officers to learn them. So there's so many recommendations that are actually very straightforward, fairly easily achievable. And on the plus side, a lot of services, as far as I know, even before the inquiry report came out, volume two, have already started making positive changes, which is encouraging.
Thank you, Fegan. Some really valid and important points there. So, Nick, what are your initial thoughts following the release of part two of the Manchester inquiry?
So, when you start to, as I'm still unpicking the report, it's a big report. But when you unpick it, and I've gone through the first 30 minutes, it's a beautifully structured report and really quite helpful in that respect. When you go through the first 30 minutes, you see some really basic omissions that have set the tone for the rest of the incident. And you see straight away that the megalith of a critical incident is now running away from those who are in control. So I think those basic steps of declaring a major incident, but more importantly, that co-location of the emergency services not happening as a very, very early stage at a forward RV, set the tone for failure. Because forget the rest of the steps in JSIP. They come because people are standing next to each other. You know, and I think the sad thing, Carl, and the thing that I'll probably, if I'm honest, take away from this mostly, is that I've seen that happen time and time again. It's not just back to 2005 and the 7/7 bombings. I've seen it happen day in, day out on boroughs. I've seen it happen in other incidents up and down the country. And there is something about our systemic inability to action learning. And if we do action it, making it sustainable. And I think, you know, at the heart of that is a lack of regular and intrusive exercising and testing, and exercising and testing by independent bodies, because we know that when, you know, when we test ourselves, particularly when we're testing procedures that we might have written, our subconscious ego gets in the way. We don't set ourselves up for failure. And so we become, you know, we start self-validating what we do. And that's really, really unhealthy. And then the other thing I saw was, you know, it does name some people. It's not comfortable. And I'm sure, you know, bless them, they're feeling awful. But I asked the question about how did we expose those people to being in a position where they were going to fail? So when the force incident manager is overwhelmed by communication, we've all been there. You know, your boss is phoning you up while you're trying to manage an incident, least helpful thing you can possibly do. We've all been asked to do things we haven't been trained to do. And I just think, I've banged on about this loads of times, so much is wrong with policing at the moment that if we don't have something of the scale of a Royal Commission, we will never move forward to be what we should be able to be.
Thanks, Nick, and to you, Fegan, as well. But we're actually coming to the end of our time. But I really want to just thank you again for being our very first guest on the Terrascope podcast to talk to us on what I think is a really, really important topic currently within protective security, especially here within the United Kingdom. So for all our guests that come on the podcast, and as a thank you to you for giving up your time, we'd like to make a charitable donation to a charity of choice for our guest speakers. So I was wondering if there was a particular charity that you'd like us to donate to on your behalf.
That's incredibly, incredibly kind of you. I suppose what jumps out would be an organisation called Kids Scan, which Martin, when he was alive, he was working for a PR company, and he was the senior account manager for that charity. And they are a children's cancer charity. They're trying to they're researching cancer treatment for children's cancer. So that would be a nice one. It's very kind.
That is no problem at all. It'd be our absolute pleasure. So just to finish off then, one of the key themes to come out of today's conversation is that any security operational risk assessment has to start with a good understanding of the threat, and that it's not a one-time thing. It's something that needs to be kept under review as terrorist attack methodologies inevitably change and evolve. And we have seen this in recent years with the growing trend of low sophistication methodologies, such as knives and using vehicles as a weapon. And it's this understanding of the threat that is at the core of us at Terrascope creating this podcast series. In a forthcoming episode, we'll be shining a light on different terrorist attack methodologies, exploring real-world case studies, and speaking with subject matter experts on the steps that we can take within protective security to mitigate them. So I hope that you will join us for our next episode.